World-famous Phil Henry Show. Joining us tonight on Crime Night is Peter Kernan. Peter is a writer, a journalist with the Chicago Tribune. But back in the 70s, he wrote a book that chronicles an event few of us remember, if any, and yet it was terribly significant at the time and it was so symbolic of a very violent decade, the 70s. Peter Kernan wrote the book, A Terrible Thunder, the story of the New Orleans sniper. And we bring Peter on our show tonight. Peter, thanks so much for being with us. And I know you're real busy out there, man, still working a crime beat, huh?
We sure are, but I'm really happy to talk to you about this tragedy, Phil.
Peter, you wrote the book originally, it was published, I should say, in 1978. There was a second printing in 2001. And as I said, I think when we think of the 70s, you know, we think of disco and we think of this and that and the Brady Bunch fashion statement. I don't think people truly remember, and the younger generation doesn't know, how violent, truly brutally violent that decade was. And before, if I'm right, in getting my dates right, before there was a Munich, am I correct in saying this was 73 or 72 when this event took place?
Absolutely. Late 72, and the real sniping, the real bad one occurred in the first week of 73.
So we had Munich. We had this. Later on, there were the zebra killings in San Francisco. But before the zebra killings was the story of Mark Essex, which you tell in this book, an ex-Navy sailor who got on top of a building and started shooting people in New Orleans, Louisiana, during this period of time. Can you start at the beginning with us, Peter, so we can get to know Mark Essex a little bit? Where was he from? What kind of a guy was he?
He was a kid who grew up in Emporia, Kansas. You know, he had had a nice, solid, peaceful, middle-class upbringing. His dad was a hard-working guy. He did well in school. He had white classmates. There were buddies, black classmates. Good sort of all-American existence out in the prairies of Kansas. He goes into the Navy, 1969, and things change pretty quickly, because it's out there that he starts to encounter, for the first time in his life, really, racial prejudice. And then, it wouldn't be a surprise, really, that the United States Navy, at least back then, was a pretty racially charged environment for a lot of people, and he had some problems there that he couldn't cope with, and he was discharged early as a result of it.
Keep going. One of the things that I'm interested in, because you mentioned his upbringing, and Peter, we're really interested in how these people are created. And
right,
while he's African American, there were plenty of African American sailors and soldiers who encountered the same prejudice, but did not
absolutely
snap as Mark Essex did. So, yeah, move on. He leaves the United States Navy. I know he got, quote, radicalized, end quote, at some point, correct?
That's a fair statement. He did. It probably started out in California, but it certainly started during this sort of murky three-month period where, after his discharge, he went to New York City and linked up with one of the cells of the Panthers in the city. And he probably, because no one knows for sure, really got the militant rhetoric pretty heavy out there during that three-month period. And this was a time, when the Eldridge Cleaver faction was duking it out with the Huey Newton faction. There had been some shooting, pretty bad shootings involving the two wings of the Black Panthers. And I think Essex was right out there in the middle of all that. And it probably shaped him for what was to happen, within a half a year down in New Orleans.
When you say what shaped him, are you saying shaped or triggered something else that was happening with him? Have you ever been able to, before we move on with the story, have you ever been able to determine what separates him from a regular Black Panther who wasn't sniping at just anything that walked? Do you know what that might be?
Phil, that's the huge question. No one really knows what set him off in the way that he was willing to do something, though, that most Panthers, most of us, but certainly the militants, were not willing to do. Namely, he was willing to shoot people. He did a lot more than talk about it. He was committed to launch an attack, mainly against white police officers. And that's what he did. It wasn't just talk with Essex. It was the real deal. But what set him off? There are a couple incidents we can talk about that certainly played a role. But what was going on in his head, Phil? Which is what you're trying to get at. That
Yeah.
Death Unknown.
I'm always fascinated with that. We're talking with Peter Hernan. Peter wrote the book, A Terrible Thunder, The Story of the New Orleans Sniper. It's a story that we're going to revisit, and we are revisiting with him because it has been buried in the history of violence in this country, and it's so important. So tell me, Peter, how does he make his way to New Orleans? Why is he in New Orleans?
Another good question. He shows up in New Orleans in the summer of 1972. And he had a friend down there, a kid that he met in the Navy. Mm-hmm. And they, for whatever reason, decided to link up in New Orleans in the summer of 72. So Mark Essex is down there. He enrolls in a jobs program where he was being trained to repair vending machines, and doing kind of well at it. No real problems. So he's down there in New Orleans, but it is kind of a smoldering period in the city.
Anger.
Of New Orleans.
And then
Mayor Clarence DeRusso told me later, that there was a quote, a whiff of revolution in the air, and that's really true. There was. So he's living in sort of a rough part of town, but in I'm forgetting the date here, but I think it was in November of 72, there was a bad shooting at Southern University in Louisiana. Uh-huh. And the Guard, where the National Guard were called out, there had been some protests. A popular professor had been canned. There are protests, and there are sheriff's deputies masked in front of these kids, mainly black kids, and a shot is fired, and you've got two dead students in Baton Rouge. And that did it, for whatever reason, for Mark Essex.
Yeah.
They found a letter that he had sent to a television station after the attack, after he went on his sniping spree, a letter that said, he was going to avenge the two deaths of these innocent brothers. And it lay unopened at a TV station for a while.
We were talking, Peter, with Dave Cullen, who wrote the book about Columbine, and I forgot to bring up with him the fact that, Eric Harris was a psychopath, but there was an incident that drove Eric Harris probably over the edge to commit the acts that he did, along with Dylan Klebold, and that was that they were arrested for breaking into a car. And it seems to me that in the minds of these folks who are already badly wired, an incident like that can do it. Was there something personal? You mentioned an incident, perhaps, that personally happened to him. I know that this shooting at Southern University was a news event. What about what happened to him? Anything you can...
Nothing that we know that personally happened to him, down in New Orleans. I mean, he was in fights with white sailors in Imperial Beach. That definitely happened to him in a very in-your-face kind of way, and he never forgot it. And he was determined, mm-hmm. I think, after that happened to him in the Navy, never to let it happen to him again. But I don't. Yeah. There's no record that there was any confrontation with police or anything. But he was. I think he was just a time bomb ready to go off.
Yeah.
And
so now the shooting happens. Yeah, Peter. Now this shooting takes place at Southern University. Mark Essex takes note of this, writes this letter to the television station.
Yes, sir.
Now we're in the late part of 1972. Tell me about when he finally does snap. His initial attack is not from the roof of the Howard Johnson's. It's an attack on. Was it like a similar to the Port Authority police? It was a certain division of the New Orleans police, correct?
No, you're good. That's exactly what happened. He on New Year's Eve, basically he's going to do his thing. He's decided it's time. So he attacks Central Lockup at the main headquarters of the New Orleans Police Department. This is the place where they bring the prisoners in. So he sets up a firing position in this vacant field about 100 yards away from the main gate of Central Lockup. And as just awful luck, awful fate would happen, a young black police cadet named Alfred Harrell, who wanted to be a New Orleans police officer, happens to be in the gate at that point, and when the first shots bring him down.
Yeah.
The first shots bring him down, and he's killed, and another bullet wounds a New Orleans police officer. So it has started at that point, approaching midnight of New Year's Eve, 1973.
Now the cops take off. Some of the cops take off in pursuit of to the area where they thought the shots were fired. Can you tell me who the main investigator was at that time? That were the first. You mentioned Bruce Weatherford at the very beginning of your book. He was also a cadet, right?
Bruce Weatherford. Yeah, he was a cadet. I'm trying to remember.
I know.
I don't remember.
Poor guy. Here's a book you wrote 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Come on, man. Let's.
It's been a few years. He's still alive. He's still with us, I believe. So.
Is he really?
But yeah.
Is he still a cop?
I don't know if he's still with the department. I don't know.
Who was the main? Who, Peter, do you recall was the main investigator? I know that the guys took off running for where they thought maybe these shots had come from. A couple of detectives, I think, were on the scene. Who took over this investigation?
You know, this was a Clarence Geruso operation. This was the New Orleans, the young New Orleans police chief, Clarence Geruso. And he got involved very quickly. He was uptown when this was going on. He's attending the Super Bowl game. I forget who Tulane was playing. But
that's right.
He's at the Super Bowl. He hops. He's a former motorcycle.
Just to correct you, the Super Bowl was at Tulane, but it was the two NFL teams. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, not a problem,
man.
It
was the Sugar Bowl. I'm sorry, Phil. It was the Sugar Bowl.
Sugar Bowl. Okay.
Sugar Bowl. And I forget which two teams were playing. It might have been Tulane. But Geruso's there. He's a Tulane grad. Jumps on a motorcycle. Thick traffic. He knows what's going on. He gets on a motorcycle. Hauls it down to where the shooting has occurred because we've got a manhunt going on. And it's sort of spreading out through an area of New Orleans then called Girt Town, which is just sort of a rough, kind of down on the heels area where there is another police shooting. Two cops are responding to a not necessarily an alarm going off, but a report of a break in an entry in a warehouse. And it's Mark Essex. He's hiding in the warehouse. Cops pull up in front of the warehouse. It's probably around midnight right now, and he opens up on them through the window when they are getting out of their car. And one officer is shot dead, and the other one is hiding behind his squad car as the bullets rain down.
I tell you what, Peter, I want to take a break. We're talking with Peter Hernan. He wrote the book, A Terrible Thunder, The Story of the New Orleans Sniper. If you go back just a little bit in your history, you will note that it was a terribly significant event in the 70s. Mark Essex. And when we get back, let's go to the rooftop of the Howard Johnson's where Mark Essex began this shooting spree and met his end with Peter Hernan. The world-famous Phil Hendry Show here on Crime Night. We'll be right back. Crime Night, and we have with us Peter Hernan, who did us all the great service of writing a book, a great historical work called A Terrible Thunder, The Story of the New Orleans Sniper. It happened in 1973. You don't hear a lot about it, because as I said to Peter at the beginning, it was a violent decade. Peter, Mark Essex has now shot two cops dead. He's wounded several others. How does he make his way to the top of the Howard Johnson's, and what transpires? This is the Howard Johnson's. Where is it located in New Orleans?
It's right in the heart of this. Right up, right by the quarter, right across from the Howard Johnson's. You have the City Hall of New Orleans. You have the Supreme Court of Louisiana. It's prime real estate in a beautiful part of the city. So there's a manhunt going on for a week. After the cadet is killed and the other cop is killed, there's a manhunt for a week trying to find who this person is. And now it's Sunday, where it's like January 6th, a Sunday, 1973, and Essex, for whatever reason, steals a car. And I think the reason is he knows his time is running out. They are after him. Lots of cops are after him.
Yeah.
Steals a car, races downtown, and pulls into the parking garage of the Howard Johnson's motel, and starts to proceed up the stairwell. And as he proceeds up the stairwell, he's encountering people. He's mainly maids, black maids, and they're locking the door on him. But on the 18th, 17th floor, he gets in to the hotel. He starts setting fires. He starts shooting people. There's a young doctor there and his wife, who ultimately the doctor tries to stop the sniper, and the doctor is shot, and the wife is then shot. Police are starting to arrive, police and firemen, mainly firemen, because they're responding to the reports of fires in the building, and he's starting to shoot firemen off the ladders. He's shooting police officers. He's incredible, you know, 100
What weapon
shot.
Does he have, Peter? What weapon is he using at this point?
He has a 44 short barrel carbine. Mm-hmm. Where he learned to shoot remains a mystery, but he was a deadly marksman. And if you were moving and if you had a blue coat on, you were in jeopardy. So it's started. You know, he's got some firemen down. He's got some police officers dead, and the siege begins. They don't know how many snipers there are. They're thinking there might be two or three or four in that building because he's good. You know, he's moving from balcony to balcony. He's setting fires. He's moving. He's shooting. They think they've got a whole squad of snipers there.
Yeah.
So as the hours progress, you're having hundreds of police officers converging on that building. You know, 400. Many of them heavily armed, and they're.
And they got one guy up there. They got one guy up there, and they think they might have three or four. Yeah,
they do. Ultimately, he is driven to the roof, Phil. He shoots the deputy police chief of the city of New Orleans, Louis Sirgo.
Oh my God!
Leading a squad up the stairwell to try to find this guy, and he is waiting above them, and he shoots Sirgo dead. So they bring him down. He was a close friend of Clarence DeRusso, who's in the lobby of the hotel, which is sort of the command post. Heavily criticized decision, but the lobby of the hotel was the command post for this operation. They bring Sirgo's body down, and that's at the point where this Marine colonel named Chuck Pittman, who's at the Belchase Naval Station downriver, he's watching it on television. And what he winds up doing in the fog and in the rain and against orders, with no orders, he flies a big C-9 helicopter under the power lines across the river, the Mississippi River, upstream, lands it next near the hotel, and walks in under fire and basically volunteers his services. Not that the Marines are going to get involved in this, but he basically offers the helicopter as a shooting platform. And, DeRusso jumps at the offer. He's again doing this. It hasn't been cleared by the Pentagon yet, but he's put his career on the line. And ultimately, it is.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it is.
Yeah.
He winds up making sortie after sortie after sortie around the roof with police marksmen aboard. And ultimately, late at night, after many and many sorties, Mark Essex runs out of this little. He was hiding in a cubicle, a little bunker, like a standpipe bunker on the roof. And he would crawl up the pipe when the shooting got heavy, and he could stay out of the line of fire that way. Well, he finally decided, I guess, enough is enough, and he charged out at the helicopter and was cut down on the roof.
Not by the marksman in the helicopter. And the interesting story about the interesting, there's many interesting aspects to this story, Peter, but was after they killed him, fire continued from the officers on the street for how long? Because they still thought they had other shooters, correct?
All night, Phil. they were seeing. They were convinced that they were dealing with another sniper, maybe two.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So in the morning now this is on national television. This, it's forgotten. You're totally right, totally forgotten. But it was on national TV. They think the remaining sniper, and there is none, but they think the remaining sniper is holed up in the elevator shaft, the elevator building on the top of the roof. So about 15 New Orleans policemen form a fan around that building, and they shoot open the doors. Bullets ricochet, and wound them. I think four or five cops were wounded on the roof. And... Ugh. They find nothing.
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 For all night. All night these guys were seeing things.
Time.
They were hearing the shots of other officers thinking that that was the sniper, and it was it probably wasn't the greatest moment for the New Orleans Police Department, would you say?
It was not the greatest moment, but it was a heroic moment in many ways for a lot of things, a lot of those men.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Individuals always rise and shine in those moments. Boy, not only are you a great writer, Peter, you're a hell of a storyteller, man, because I'm telling you, I've had so many people who've written books come on the show, and you got to really kind of lead them by the hand. You've got a great recollection of this, and I just have to tell people again, the name of the book is A Terrible Thunder, The Story of the New Orleans Sniper. Peter Hernan is the author, and if you really want to understand the 70s, you have to read books like this, and I can't think of a better one to start with. Peter, thanks a lot, man, and take care out there, Hara, on those main streets.
All the best.
All right, brother. Thank you. Peter Hernan, the book is A Terrible Thunder. Buy it online at Amazon. It was published in 1978. and reprinted in 2001. It is a book worth revisiting to understand the history of our country, crime and violence in our country. Okay, you're listening to the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. We have with us Dr. Sam Vakhtin. Dr. Vakhtin is a self-proclaimed psychopath. He is the author of a book called Malignant Self-Love. His field of study and his doctorate is in philosophy. He has also been featured in a recent documentary, and I'm not sure exactly when it's going to be released, called I, Psychopath. He is a convicted corporate criminal. I mean, that's, Dr. Vakhtin, that's a heck of a it's a heck of a resume, isn't it? Philosopher.
Right.
Psychopath.
Right.
Criminal. The subject of a movie.
Actually, I'm a diagnosed narcissist rather than a self-proclaimed psychopath. But I agree with you that the line between psychopathy and narcissism is very blurred.
Just for the purposes of informing my audience, Doctor, let's start out with your life. A philosopher, you're an educated man. Where are you from originally?
I was born in Israel. That makes me an Israeli, I suspect.
Okay. Where are you living now, if you don't mind me asking? Are you in Europe?
Not at all. I'm residing in Macedonia, and I've been working in the Balkans, in Russia, in the Czech Republic, in all these charming Eastern European areas since 1993.
And you're specializing now in personality disorder, but let's get to the to this diagnosis. You say that you're self-diagnosed as a psychopath, if we could use that word, because you have indicated there's very little distinction there between narcissist and psychopath. How did this happen that you came to realize? I don't think, I've never heard of, and I'd have to find out if there's any other individual in the world who has self-diagnosed or has become aware of their psychopathy and has gone out to try to deal with it. How did you first become aware of this?
Self-diagnosis is an oxymoron, and I did not self-diagnose. I was diagnosed. I was diagnosed twice by two psychiatrists,
okay,
10 years apart. I had no idea whatsoever that something was wrong with me. This lack of self-awareness, this defective introspection, the whole introspective apparatus of the narcissist is simply not functioning. So for the longest time, I was sure that everything was okay with me, and that's the problem was with the world. Only when I went through a series of massive personal crises, only when I hit rock bottom, I was in prison, incarcerated, I lost my first wife, I lost all my property and all my assets, and so on and so forth. And of course, I lost my reputation, my social standing, everything I had accumulated until that time. Only then did I realize something was wrong with me. And only then did I submit myself to mental health professionals. And they, 10 years apart, diagnosed me similarly with personality disorder.
Dr. Vakhtin, we have psychopaths, sadistic psychopaths, and we'll separate you from them because these are murderous psychopaths, who go all the way to the electric chair claiming that the world is what's the problem and not them. So how is it that you were able to sort of stop at some point in your life? I mean, these are guys that go to prison. These are guys that are incarcerated. The world hates them. They've been charged with heinous, vicious acts, and they go all the way to their death claiming that it isn't me. I didn't do it. It was somebody else. So how did somehow in your life this moment occur that you were able to turn that analysis back on yourself?
Well, Freud has made a very pertinent distinction between knowledge or cognitive knowledge and insight, which is something you internalize. And insight activates psychodynamics. Insight generates change. I gained no insight. I gained cognitive knowledge of my disorder. In other words, while I talk the talk, I don't walk the walk. It's wow. expedient for me to say that I'm to blame. It's my new persona. It's my new brand, if you wish. But I didn't really internalize. I didn't really assimilate, digest, and accept this new sort of turn of events. In my deep in my mind, not even in the unconscious, but very consciously, I still believe that something's wrong with the world. The world, people are mm-hmm. inferior. People are stupid.
Mm-hmm.
People
mm-hmm.
are mm-hmm. undeserving. People are ungrateful, ingrates, and so on and so forth. People are always, there's yeah. always something wrong with my environment, both human yeah. and non-human. I tend to blame
Can I ask you
and machines.
Can I ask you
designed.
Can I ask you let me ask you a question right now. What do you think, and be honest, well, I mean, I guess, well, that's a good question for a psychopath, I guess, be honest. What do you think of me?
What do I think of you?
Yes.
I don't think of you. You're a function, an instrument.
Narcissistic
psychopaths tend to objectify their interlocutors right. and anyone else who comes into their orbit. And that includes their nearest and dearest. They strip them down to bare essences and to bare functional essences. So right. you are my interviewer.
And I'm able to allow you to tell your story. I'm a conduit for which you can use to communicate. Correct?
Well, yes. That's one way of putting it. Yeah, you facilitate
and forgive
my interaction with the world. You're
forgive these questions, but I think it's important. Yeah, I think it's important for people to understand what you're talking about.
There's nothing personal in that. There's
no. I'm not taking it personal.
It's sure. absolutely an objective assessment of the world as I perceive it.
I understand it, sir. Let me ask you, are you better than me?
I don't know you enough. I have a very high IQ. I have certain
yeah.
achievements and accomplishments, but so do you, of course. So it's not a question of... When I say superiority, I am not talking mm-hmm. about a tally or an inventory of achievements. I'm not talking about position. I'm not talking about prestige or status or assets or whatever. I'm talking about an innate sort of trait, an innate quantity that sets
right.
us, psychopathic narcissists, apart from the great unwashed. That's all, sort
right.
of.
Right.
And it's not something operational. It's not that we go around and say, you know, this guy's inferior. It's an absolutely automatic reaction. It's not something that
I hear you.
We contemplate or ponder. Yeah.
No, I understand. I believe I understand. I'm not saying that I could ever understand it the way you do, but I've at least read enough about the state of mind. And I want to let my audience know we're talking to Dr. Sam Vaknin. He joins us tonight on Crime Night. He's a self-proclaimed psychopath and a convicted corporate criminal. He's also the author of Malignant Self-Love, Narcissism Revisited, and is the center of a documentary called I, Psychopath. So I understand as well as I can, Doctor, that you're not speaking personally of me. It's just how you are. All right, Sam, I know that, but would you prefer Doctor, or is it it's Sam's
name
for
you,
Sam,
right? No, Sam, absolutely not. Call me Sam.
Okay. And you asked me to call you Sam because you realize that that's better for you in terms of making your case, right? You're not trying to befriend me or anything, correct?
No, I'm not trying to befriend you due to objective circumstances. We're far apart, we're unlikely to meet, and so on and so forth. No, I'm asking you to call me Sam because my doctorate is irrelevant to the topic of the conversation. My doctorate is in philosophy,
gotcha.
Not in psychology or anything else.
Now, Sam, and I want to get into the circumstances of this, the problem in your professional career that led you to be convicted of a crime. But I wanted to ask you about your personal life. Are you currently married? I know you were married, correct?
Yes, I'm currently married to a lovely woman called...
And let me ask you about that. Do you love this woman?
Well, there is a problem in philosophy called the problem of intersubjectivity. Our inability to ascertain that what you feel and what I feel are one and the same thing. I don't know if when you feel pain and I feel pain, owing to the same reason, we actually feel the same thing. So yes, in my way, I love her, of course. But whether mm-hmm. this is dependence, whether this is admiration of a utility, whether this is some reaction, some formative reaction, there's no way of determining this for sure.
Yeah.
I feel, I experience what I believe to be love. And I believe
okay.
it to be love because I've read about it, I've talked to other people and so on, I compared experiences. It seems to me to be love, yes.
Would you lay your life down for her? Can you see an instance or a moment where you would rather it be you who died than her?
If it guaranteed me everlasting fame, glory, and admiration, probably I would.
Really?
Anything for narcissistic supply, absolutely.
I want to ask you one final question before the break, and please, I'll try and make it as clear as I can. What is the possibility that an individual, in order to gain some approbation for himself, would claim to be psychopathic because he understands all of the symptoms, articulate himself as a psychopath, but in point of fact is not?
It's easy to imitate psychopathy or narcissism. Narcissists and psychopaths are kind of automata. They are easily predictable. They are pretty rigid. Their personalities are rigid and precariously balanced. They are pretty predictable. And they are easily manipulable and very gullible, by the way. So it's easy to imitate them. And it's a vicious logical circle, it's a circular
yeah.
If one right. goes to the extent of imitating a narcissist, isn't that in itself a narcissistic act? And if one claims to be a psychopath, wouldn't only a psychopath do that?
It's an interesting question. Except what's the end game, and what is the end result? But let's save that for our conversation after the break. We are talking to Dr. Sam Vaknin. He is a philosopher, but we're talking specifically about the fact that he is a psychopath, self-proclaimed and diagnosed, and a convicted corporate criminal. The author of *Malignant Self-Love: Narcissism Revisited*. I've got to get the book and read it. And the center of the film, I, Psychopath. We'll be right back with Dr. Vaknin in a moment here on the world-famous Phil Henry Show, which is, in a way, a bit narcissistic, but I realize I'm kidding when I say that. We'll be back here on the Phil Henry Show in a minute.
Phil Henry. Phil Henry.
World famous Phil Henry Show, back here with Dr. Sam Vaknin, a self-proclaimed psychopath. Dr. Vaknin, we were talking at the break about how a person could imitate being a psychopath because, as you said, they're gullible and predictable. And I want to ask you, and then you said that, well, isn't that in and of itself psychopathic? But what about the end result? What if, for instance, I wanted to imitate a psychopath? I went out on the talk show circuit. I did all of these interviews because I wanted to gain money to support my family. Perhaps a daughter who needs to go to school or a son that wants to have a career or so forth. In other words, there was a larger a love, if you will, at work.
It's the eternal question of whether mm-hmm. we do have an inner landscape and a series of outer manifestations which accurately represent this landscape. So if you behave as a psychopath, if you act as a psychopath, if you harm your environment as psychopaths do, if you display a lack of empathy and a lack and an absence of conscience, if you commit criminal acts, if you're antisocial, and so on and so forth, what is the difference between you and a true quote-unquote psychopath? It's the inner landscape. But how can we ascertain that this inner landscape exists? Do we have access to anyone's inner emotions, inner cognitions? No, we don't. It's a serious...
Well,
when we discuss the psyche, when we discuss the soul, if you wish, when we discuss the psychological makeup of people, we make a series of assumptions based solely and exclusively on their outward behaviors. So it is conduct that decides the diagnosis.
If I found you so fast, Dr. Vecten, if I found you to be so fascinating, and I do, that I wanted to travel to Macedonia and I wanted to sit at your feet and learn from you, that would only increase your sense of self-aggrandizement, wouldn't it? You wouldn't really be touched by that. You wouldn't feel like, well, here's a student that, you know, wants to learn from me. You would think that it would all be about you, wouldn't it?
Narcissists are binary machines. They react to the absence or existence of narcissistic supply. Narcissistic supply is a professional term that describes adoration, admiration, adulation, attention, or being feared and being hated. These are also forms of narcissistic supply. So, yes, I'm a binary machine. If you provide me with narcissistic supply, I idealize you, I value you, I cherish you, I nurture you, I manipulate you, and I maintain you. If I judge the quality of narcissistic supply emanating from you to have deteriorated or to be at risk of vanishing, then I would instantly devalue you, discard you, humiliate you probably in the process, and then ignore you completely.
These are the two states
in which narcissists exist. There's no third state.
So if I died during the in the middle of our burgeoning relationship, you would simply say, okay, that source of narcissistic supply is gone. Time to look for another one or wait for one to come along, correct?
Oh, I'd be devastated, as you would be devastated if you had lost a precious asset. But I would be devastated.
An asset.
Not because you had died, but because I've lost my source of supply.
Interesting.
So I would have an emotional reaction which would emulate grief. But I would be grieving for myself, not for you.
And can I ask you, Sam, you would be emulating that grief. You said emulate, so you would be feeling grief for yourself, but you would emulate grief so that others would think that you were normal?
Narcissists and psychopaths try very hard. They often fail, and they look very awkward when they do this. But they try very hard to cast their extremely deviant and unusual set of mind into socially acceptable molds. They often do that. So you have psychopathic CEOs and psychopathic presidents and psychopathic, successful people, so pillars of the community. And they are acting. Psychopaths are thespians. They're actors. They're great actors. However, it's felt that they're acting. It's somehow they're fake, and it comes through.
Yeah.
Not at the very beginning, but usually on second or third encounter.
I have to ask you this question. I was going to ask you about your own crime, the crimes that you committed that brought you to bottom, and perhaps I should, but I'm more interested to ask you this. You're looking at the financial state of the world as we all are. You know what happened here in America with the Ponzi schemes and so on and so forth, and we know that psychopaths can create a lot more damage than their numbers represent. How much of this do you think how much of what's happened to the world financially do you think has been driven by psychopaths?
Well,
in business, in the banking business.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
I've recently written an article about brokers and bankers as malignant psychopaths, as psychopathic narcissists. I'm sorry. It's a confluence. It's a culture of narcissism, to borrow from Christopher Lash, the culture of narcissism that encouraged, abetted, and aided the emergence and the resurgence of psychopathic narcissists, placed them in positions of authority, adulated them, and gave them, legitimized their acts, their lack of compassion, their lack of empathy. Actually, they were idolized precisely because of their narcissism and precisely because of their antisocial traits. It's a cultural thing rather than an individual thing. And
Sam, I want to ask you this question. I would be fascinated to know your answer to. Do you see any individual on the modern day scene in the news that you would say, "Aha, this guy he's a fellow traveler. He's a psychopath." Can you name a name? Would you feel comfortable doing that?
Psychopaths or narcissists, and there is distinction. I mean, narcissists are very concerned with narcissistic supply. They are concerned with input from the outside. They sustain and regulate their sense of self-worth by garnering and fostering reactions in other people. So they are dependent on other people. Psychopaths are not. No, psychopaths are lone wolves. Psychopaths are highly individualistic. Psychopaths are antisocial, while narcissists are actually over-social, gregarious, if you wish. So there is this distinction. So the better question, if I may rephrase the question, the better question would be if I identify narcissists, because narcissists are more likely to become, as I said, pillars of a community, appear in the media, and so on and so forth. They are more likely to gravitate. Mm-hmm. But I raise the question and the possibility that President Barack Obama may have pronounced narcissistic traits and potentially, subject, of course, to diagnosis, interviews, and so on and so forth, may suffer from NPD. That is speculation, obviously.
Yeah.
I haven't met the man, I'm not qualified to diagnose him, even had I met him. But after 14 years of studying narcissism, I think that I gained a modicum of intuition, and based on previous cases. So that's my feeling.
It's very interesting. And I will call you Doctor one final time, Dr. Sam Vackman. Thank you so much. It's really interesting, and you're an interesting guy. And your book is called Malignant Self-Love, Narcissism Revisited. Dr. Sam Vackman has been with us tonight on Crime Night. I thank you very much, sir,
for
being with us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
You bet, anytime. This is the world famous, and I'm kidding. Well, actually, I think we are world famous. Phil Hendry Show.
Phil Hendry.